This is the Feminem Podcast, the official podcast of Feminem, discussing all things femme, a little bit of EM, and everything in between. I'm Jenny Beck-Esme, editor-in-chief of Feminem. Now, just first, another plug to make sure you're getting your ticket to the Fix 18 conference. We have less than 100 attending tickets to go, to be sold. They're going really fast. And like I mentioned last week, we are all out already of our resident tickets. So be sure to get yourself on that resident wait list if you're interested in a resident ticket. And stay tuned over the next few weeks. We are working on some creative solutions to get more residents to be able to come to Fix 18. So pay attention and stay tuned for those updates. So now on to our next Fix 17 talk. This is a talk called A Vaccine for Violence by Dr. Rob Gore. He's an EM attending at Kings County, and he's the executive director of CAVI, which is the Kings Against Violence Initiative. And this is a multifactorial hospital, school, and community-based violence intervention and prevention program. In his talk, Dr. Gore talks about how he came up with the idea for CAVI and what CAVI does, and talks about what we can do as healthcare providers to help stop the epidemic of violence in our communities. This is a really timely and important talk. Take a listen.
Thank you for having me. Matter of fact, I think this is the largest audience of women I've spoken at since before I used to sneak on Spelman College's campus during off hours. First, I actually want to let you know I have nothing to disclose. Actually, I do have one thing to disclose. Some of the images may be pretty disturbing, and so if you have to turn your head away or have to leave the room, I completely understand. But we're going to start with a couple of cases. First case, you have a 22-year-old male who presents to the emergency department after being shot multiple times to the chest and to the upper extremity. After repeated examinations and multiple diagnostic studies, we determined that there are no vascular injuries and there are no bony injuries. And the wound to the anterior chest is only a graze wound, which is good. So you get ready to prepare to discharge the patient home. And right before he leaves, he tells you, "Doc, I've been shot before." So knowing this information, what do you do? Next case, we have a 20-year-old woman who comes in with a GSW to the right hand. As you can see, there are multiple metacarpal injuries. On physical examination, there's vascular compromise. So while the patient's being prepared to go to the operating room for operative repair, you walk past the room and you overhear a conversation. One of her family members says, "We know who did this and we're gonna make that person pay." You make eye contact with the family members. They make eye contact with you. So at this point, what do you do? So these are some questions I kept asking myself over and over and over again when I was a resident at Cook County Hospital and as a junior attending at Kings County Hospital. I was surprised not just the sheer numbers of patients that were coming in, but there were a couple of key things. One, all the patients were my age. Number two, they were also the same ethnicity as me. And number three, these patients were coming from the same neighborhoods that I lived in. And so kind of looking at this stuff and thinking back, whenever something affects you personally, you tend to have a different experience with it. Some people have a visceral reaction, but I didn't want to just do a Band-Aid approach to dealing with trauma patients. So I started looking at violence and trauma more from a public health framework, looking at violence as a disease process, that if we intervene, we could change the scope of violence. But it's interesting. You know, we see violence all the time in our place of work. However, we can't really and truly understand violence unless we understand one key concept, and that's the concept of power. Sociologist Wade Noble said that power is the ability to define reality. In South Africa, the old system of government known as apartheid, which was based on separation, segregation, and discrimination, where you have an exogenous group of people misappropriating power to ensure social, economic, and political dominance over indigenous people. Hip-hop artist and entrepreneur Nas rapped, "It's that shit that moves crowds, making every ghetto foul. I might have took your first child, scarred your life, crippled your style. I gave you power, I made you buck wild." Nas rapped these brilliant words when he was talking about the power that came from a gun. But power is so interesting. You know, people have been fearful of power, and with good reason. Those who are in positions of power have a fear that power is going to be taken away from them. Those who aren't in positions of power are fearful that those who are in power are going to exercise power on them for not having in the first place. It's because power is influence, power is control. Power can be divisive, power can instill fear, power can be oppressive. But when power affects every aspect of your life, its presence or its absence can lead to conflict, and that conflict can then result into violence. We have a problem with violence in the United States. Violence is the number two cause of death for Latino youth ages 15 to 34. It's the number two cause of death for Black women ages 15 to 24. It's also the number one cause of death for Black men ages 15 to 34. From our experience working in the emergency department, we know that violence and trauma is a recurrent phenomenon. If somebody's been shot or stabbed, that rate of re-injury is as high as 40%, actually 44%, within 5 years after that initial injury. The rate for subsequent homicide is as high as 20% within that five-year time frame. Each subsequent injury increases that rate. But who comes into the hospital? Who are these patients that come back? What are the risk factors? So having violence, being exposed to violence in the household, whether it's domestic violence that's occurring or intimate partner violence, doing poorly in school or school failure, substance abuse, repeated exposure to violence, whether it's through media or video games, gang involvement. These are members of the Bloods gang in Bed-Stuy, Brooklyn, where I live. Having easy access to weapons. These are guns being sold at an internet gun sale. Pre-existing mental illness is a major risk factor for patients who come in and continuously come in for repeated traumas. Frustrated with my work realities, and because a lot of the stuff was taking place in the neighborhood I live in, I launched a program called CAVI, which stands for the Kings Against Violence Initiative. CAVI is a multifactorial hospital, school, and community-based violence intervention and prevention program. And CAVI operates using a trauma-informed care model. And for those who aren't familiar with trauma-informed care is a tailored approach focusing specifically on treatment of patients who've been affected by violence and trauma, focusing on a number of things, making sure that the patients are safe, making sure that we provide emotional support and well-being. Think about it. You've been injured as a result of violence. There are high numbers of PTSD that patients experience, but yet when they come into our emergency departments, we say, come back in 7 days to have your stitches looked at and stay out of trouble, not paying attention to the mental health needs. So it's important to pay attention to the emotional needs of these patients. We also help patients work and cope with loss after they may have lost a loved one who's been a victim of violence. And last but not least, helping patients and their families develop future plans so that, that patient doesn't come back, but also so that they can navigate through life adjusting for their recent mishaps. So our hospital program works with young people who've been shot and stabbed, with the key goal making sure they don't come back with repeat injuries. When somebody comes into the emergency department who's been shot or stabbed, there's a note that goes in from nursing triage. Triage contacts our social workers and our violence intervention team. We call them hospital responders. The hospital responders then talk to the patients. They talk to the family members to ensure retaliation doesn't occur. But a key thing, making sure that those patients have an advocate. During busy shifts, or what my residents tend to call gore shifts, where you don't really have a whole lot of time to sit down, and some of my former residents are in this room and current residents, so I hear them laughing. But during gore shifts, you don't have a lot of time to talk to some of your patients and to the extent that they need. And remember, you're dealing with patients who have physical trauma, but also they're suffering from a lot of mental trauma. So our hospital responders, who are also credible messengers, coming from the neighborhoods in which we serve, some of them have been formerly incarcerated, some of them have been injured in the past, but all are committed to making sure that our trauma patients are well taken care of. They talk with the patients, they do follow-up while the person is an inpatient, and follow them up once they've been discharged from the hospital to make sure their needs are well met. We also have school and community programs. As a matter of fact, I was talking with one of the members here at FEMINEM, and this is my teaching fellowship project for ASAP. We have 250 kids that we work with in our school and community programs in Brooklyn. We work with four high schools, and during the school day, we have an entire curriculum that we work with young people who are considered to be at risk. So kids who have histories of frequent fighting or doing poorly in school, gang involvement or gang affiliation. Some are just in need of mentorship like we all needed at that age, but some are also coping with major trauma that's been experienced in their home environment and or their neighborhoods. Our curriculum focuses on mediation, conflict resolution, skill development, project and idea development. We were focused on restorative justice practices, understanding things like power and oppression to make sure that our patients and our clients are able to navigate their neighborhoods successfully and safely. Our community program is a little bit different, and we focus on junior high school age kids. This is done after school. We meet with them at least 3 days a week, doing an age-modified curriculum. Now, when you think about violence, we often think about young men as being the face of violence. But women of color are, you know, have major risk factors when you start thinking about violence and homicide. Women of color have higher homicide rates than other populations. It's the number two cause of death for black women ages 15 to 24. Women of color have higher reported rates of domestic violence or intimate partner violence. Women of color also have higher reported rates of self-harm. And when you start looking at school-age children, women of color also have higher reported rates of bullying, whether it's cyberbullying or physical bullying in school. Because women have a different experience violence very differently from men, we wound up tailoring our programming, and we have our Kavi Queens program. Kavi Queens, we currently have close to 90 young women who are a part of our school-based programs, and we have a tailored approach to help them deal with the same violence and trauma that some young men are dealing with, but from a different approach. The goal is not just to provide counseling services. We want to make sure that our young women are kept safe. We want to make sure they're able to deal with and process trauma. But most importantly, we want them to be able to heal from traumas that they've been experiencing in their own communities. But last but not least, you have to think. Not every high school, not every junior high school is going to have a Kavi violence intervention program. Not every hospital is going to have its own tailored violence intervention program. All level one trauma centers have to have an injury prevention program that's affiliated with them in order to maintain their level one status. But not everything is going to be as comprehensive as some other programs around the United States. But there are some things that we can do as emergency physicians as emergency practitioners. One, we can advocate for policies that affect violence, particularly thinking about things like the assault weapons ban. That's one thing. The other thing we can do, and this is on the most basic level, providing information about other programs in the area. Everybody uses Google. My residents use it all the time. But you can Google a violence intervention program or some sort of youth program that a parent or a patient may benefit from. And if you don't remember anything else, advocate for safety. When we discharge patients home who've been injured, a lot of times we pay so much close attention to the physical injuries that we don't pay attention to what happens after. So if you have a young woman who's been shot in the lobby of her apartment building, and she has a through-and-through injury, and there are no vascular injuries, and you say, you know what, she's safe to go home, but then you're going to discharge her back to that same facility, that same place that injury took place in. That's not cool, and that's not safe. And you start having somebody who begins self-medicating because of agoraphobia, because of increased anxiety, which leads to so many other things and helps them re-enter that cycle of violence over and over again. Remember, these aren't just our clients. This is not just patient in room number one or in trauma one. These are people who have real lives, they have real families, and they want to do more than just survive. They want to thrive. Thank you.